to the Lowy Institute. I'm Aaron Connolly. I'm the director of the Southeast Asia project here. And let me first acknowledge that this event is being held on the traditional land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, to pay respect to their elders past and present, and to any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander peoples who are in the audience today. Ladies and gentlemen, over the course of nearly 60 years' engagement with Southeast Asia, Dr. Milton Osborne has become one of Australia's and indeed the world's leading authorities on the region. Following an unexpected posting to Phnom Penh from 1959 to 1961, Milton completed doctoral studies at Cornell in the United States before returning to Southeast Asia for research throughout the 1960s and 70s. Later, in the early 80s, he served as a consultant to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees on the Thai-Cambodian border, resolving a crisis that has echoes today in the Rohingya crisis in Bangladesh. This fascinating quarter century of his early career in Southeast Asia is the period covered in his new book that we are launching today, Pol Pot Solved the Leprosy Problem, Remembering Colonial and Postcolonial Worlds, 1956 to 1981. It is only the latest in a long line of work and scholarship on the region. To take just one example, Milton's Southeast Asia and Introductory History, first published in 1979, is now in its 12th edition and has been translated into 5 Asian languages. In 2013, the French government honored him with an appointment as a Commandeur de l'Ordre National du Mérite for his writing on France in Asia and his role in liaison with French officials. From 1982 to 1993, Milton returned to Australian government service as head of the Asia branch of the Office of National Assessments in Canberra. He has since held various academic appointments, including most recently as a non-resident fellow of the Lowy Institute, where he has been a fixture of our Southeast Asia programs and a source of great experience and wisdom for those of us working on the region here. Shortly, I will invite Milton up to make some introductory remarks on his latest work, after which we will have a conversation about the book and open the floor up to questions. I should note that this session is being recorded and will be distributed on our podcast channel for a large worldwide audience. But for now, please join me in welcoming Milton Osborne to the rostrum.
Thank you very much, Aaron, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming along to hear the very self-interested presentation of my talking about my own book. Let me move straight to an explanation of the book's title, which is not some catchy phrase pulled out of the air, but rather is, in fact, an abbreviated quotation. In 1981, I returned to Cambodia after an absence of some 10 years. It was a period that was marked by the closing stages of the terrible civil war that took place in Cambodia, followed by the 3 years, 8 months, and 20 days of the tyranny of the Pol Pot regime, and then a very uncertain period, which was extremely difficult in terms of people's capacity to travel to Cambodia over the period following the Vietnamese invasion that took place beginning on Christmas Eve 1978 and was effectively completed by the 7th of January 1979. In 1981, after much effort, I was enabled to return to Vietnam and then to Cambodia. The Vietnamese government initially was very reluctant to let me return to Vietnam, and I had never been to northern Vietnam at that stage, and I was told that if I joined the Vietnamese-Australian Friendship Association, I could possibly receive a visa. And I explained as politely as I could that I was not in those terms a friend of Vietnam. And after 18 months of to-ing and fro-ing, I suddenly was told that I could go to Vietnam and that, although the Vietnamese government, I was told I should know completely that the Vietnamese government was not in fact in charge of Cambodia, they might be able to assist me to return to Cambodia as well. And so I had a privileged visit to both Vietnam and Cambodia in 1981, which included, amongst other things, the opportunity to spend an hour on my own talking to the Vietnamese foreign minister, Nguyen Co Thaich, and led to me spending some 10 days in Cambodia. In the course of the time I spent in Cambodia, I traveled to the northwest to Battambang City, where I met Dr. Li Po. Now, Dr. Li Po was one of the rare medical doctors who survived the Khmer Rouge period. And he told me that he had at one stage been imprisoned with 480 people in a Khmer Rouge prison, of whom 50 survived. He was one of them. He showed me around his hospital. He was a vigorous and engaging figure, and he described to me the opportunities and the problems that he had in the province, because he was both the director of the hospital and of the province's health service. And he enumerated the problems, the shortage of supplies, the lack of sufficient money, the need to try and find ways of dealing with this. But he said, there's one thing we don't have to worry about. There's no leprosy problem in the province. The Pol Pot government, he said, solved the leprosy problem. They killed all the lepers. The book reflects, as Aaron has said, the period I spent from having been first sent to Cambodia in 1959 to the period when I returned to government service in 1981. My being sent to Cambodia as a very young diplomat, I was 22 when I arrived in Phnom Penh, came as a complete shock to me. When I joined Foreign Affairs, or External Affairs as it was at that time, I had expected to spend some 2 years in Canberra before being sent overseas. And so I had no expectation that I would be sent to Cambodia, a country about which I knew very little and had no sense that it was going to be part of my life in any way. In November of 1958, still less than a year of having been in Canberra, I was summoned and told I was being sent to Phnom Penh as Third Secretary in the Australian Legation. It wasn't even a full embassy at the time. I immediately wondered whether this had something to do with the fact that I had dropped a catch off the bowling of the head of the department, the formidable Sir Arthur Tang, and that this was punishment, because Phnom Penh was just about as far away as you could send anyone from the Australian Foreign Service. And I also was unaware of just how difficult it was going to be in terms of the circumstances I would find there. I was so ignorant that when I emerged into the corridor after being told of my posting, that I stood and must have looked extremely dazed, because one of my older colleagues, I remember his name very well, Pierre Hutton, came to me and said, "You look like a young man who's just been told he's being posted overseas." And I said, "Yes, I'm being sent to Phnom Penh." And he said, "How wonderful, you'll be able to see Angkor." And I didn't know what he was talking about. But I did save myself from eternal shame by not saying Angkor Wat. Later, much later, I was able to say boldly, I thought at the time, even 25 years after I'd been sent to Phnom Penh, I was able to say to Sir Arthur Tang, "Was there any connection between my dropping a catch off your bowling and being sent to Phnom Penh?" And he looked at me without saying anything for fully 30 seconds before saying, "Made a career of it, didn't you?" Now, the book deals with Cambodia, but it also deals with Vietnam, where in the 1960s I spent a great deal of time, including some 6 weeks living in the house as a house guest of a Vietnamese senator in the South Vietnamese regime, a period that enabled me to spend a great deal of time traveling with a significant figure, Chan Van Don, one of the key figures in the overthrow of Ngo Dinh Diem in 1963. Let me just say one more technical thing about the book. When I went to Phnom Penh for the first time, which was both a culture shock and a wonderful preparation for a career, I did not keep a daily journal, and I regretted it ever after I left, so that when I returned to go back to Cambodia and Vietnam in 1966 as an overaged and underpaid graduate student, I kept a daily journal, and I continued to keep a daily journal every time I went back to Southeast Asia from that point on, so that when in the book I record in considerable detail long conversations that I had with various figures, Those are the reflections of the Daily Journal, not written up before going to bed like Samuel Pepys, but written up early next morning in each case. Now, I'm not pretending that the records of conversation that I've kept are verbatim, but I would claim that they are detailed, and certainly in some of the key phrases, like the one I mentioned about Dr. Li Po, those phrases are directly recorded because they're ones that I did indeed note down as soon as I could after the conversations in question. The book is personal, originally written as a long letter to my daughter, because she wasn't born when much of the book was taking place, much of the events of the book were taking place. And even though it's become something rather longer and more detailed than I originally intended, it perhaps still is a long letter to my daughter.
Thank you. Thanks, Milton. That's a great introduction to the book. And I was just, I'm struck by your story and the stories in the book of your experiences as a young diplomat in Phnom Penh, fairly out-of-the-way place at that time. And given the fact that you were just 23 years old when you first arrived, and that you were left as chargé d'affaires for periods as long as 3 weeks at the embassy, that is a level of authority and responsibility that DFAT officers today could only dream of. What was it like being chargé d'affaires at 23 in Phnom Penh in the late 50s, early 60s?
I think the honest answer is that although it was a great surprise, it didn't seem too impossible at the time for me, partly because the Australian legation, and then it became the Australian embassy, was in good odour with the Cambodian government at the time. And the Cambodian senior figures, ministers, highly placed officials in the foreign ministry, were extremely civilised in the way that which they treated me as a chargé d'affaires. It did open up experiences which I would simply not have had and would be very difficult to have nowadays. To be invited to dancing evenings in the palace, where Sihanouk led a band of princes, warbling French chansons and Cambodian popular songs, and saying at 2 o'clock in the morning, "Well, the king and queen have gone home now, but I'm going to play till dawn, and I hope you'll all stay." And of course, we all did. So it was a range of experiences that perhaps, as you say, would be very unlikely to take place now. But because Phnom Penh was indeed a special place, it was one that somehow or other was easy to accommodate.
Tell us a little bit about the other diplomats that you were in Phnom Penh with. There's a number of colorful descriptions of other diplomats from other embassies and legations in Phnom Penh at that time. At one point, you describe all of you running around following Sihanouk in white sharkskin suits, looking like a convention of rather seedy ice cream sellers. But there were quite a few characters there, weren't there?
Well, the real characters were certainly to be found in the French embassy, and most of all, the deputy head of mission, Pierre Matavet de la Ville de Mimont, who was elegant, handsome, debonair. He rotated his first and second wives through Phnom Penh on a regular basis and introduced them in those terms: ma première femme, ma deuxième femme. And they were extremely attractive women. He was also reported, I never actually saw this myself, reported to keep a baboon in the house. Some French gossip suggested the baboon shared Matavet's bed as well, but that was another thing. The British ambassador, who was extremely kind to me, the British embassy was right next door to the Australian embassy on the Boulevard Norodom. The British ambassador and his wife were indeed real characters too, Freddie and Muriel Garner. Both had been in China before the Second World War. Both had been imprisoned, interned during the Second World War by the Japanese. And perhaps as a reflection of how youthful I was, I asked Freddie Garner, whom I referred to as Sir, of course, what it was like to be interned by the Japanese in China during the war. And he gave me a wonderfully, if I dare say, a wonderfully British answer. He said, well, since I'd been educated at Rugby, it really wasn't too bad. And indeed, I was on the garbage routine, the garbage roundup in the camp, so I ate rather better than most people. Muriel Garner was a fearsome lady in her own right, but perhaps I'll leave that till another time. It's in the book.
You'll have to pick up the book for those stories. And you continued to visit Cambodia through the 1960s and 70s. And in the course of recounting events then, you cover a number of characters in the Cambodian elite at the time, and really a kind of Southeast Asian elite that doesn't exist in mainland Southeast Asia today, very much educated in the French system, fluent in French, and very much part of that colonial culture. Can you tell us a little bit about some of your friends from Cambodia during that period?
I was very fortunate when I first went to Cambodia. I made the acquaintance and became a friend of Prince Sisawat Panduravong, with whom I maintained a contact until very recently when his health failed. He was a wonderful guide to what was happening in the Cambodia of those days. But I also made other friends in my first time in Cambodia. And when I say friends, I'm not just talking about acquaintances. I'm talking about people like Captain Kim Kosal, who ultimately was murdered by the Khmer Rouge, whom I met first of all in 1959, and then when I went back to Cambodia in 1966 as a graduate student, our friendship was such that he invited me to spend a weekend on his army post where he commanded a battalion. This was an essence of friendship that was really very special. It was also in 1966 that I met Father Tep Im, as he then was, a Cambodian priest who had been educated in France and in the Angelicum University in Rome. And these were people who had a link with the West that is quite different to, I think, the sorts of links that people have today. I don't think they felt that they were un-Cambodian in any sense because of their links with the West, but it was certainly an attachment to an education in the West and involvement with Western ideas that would be very difficult to find today.
And you also speak of going back to Cambodia years later, but tracking events in between. And of course, in 1975, April 17th, the Khmer Rouge takes power in Phnom Penh. Tell us, if you don't mind, a little bit about what happened to some of your friends under the Khmer Rouge rule.
Well, of the friends I've just mentioned so far, both Kim Kosal and Father Tep Im, or he had become Monsignor Tep Im by the time the Khmer Rouge took over, both were executed by the Khmer Rouge. In an earlier book published in 1979 and then reprinted in 1984, I write in some detail about Kim Kosal, about Father Tep Im, Monsignor Tep Im, about the father of my good close friend Sisawat Panduravong, Prince Esaravong. They all were people who stood out as being part of a culture that the Khmer Rouge simply couldn't accept. It leads on, if I may, to my concern about how the West wrote about or did not write about what was happening once the Khmer Rouge took power. In 1975, as I've mentioned before, the Khmer Rouge took power in Phnom Penh. They took power on the 17th of April of 1975, a date that's easy for me to remember since my birthday. All foreigners in Cambodia were then sent out of Cambodia. They were held in the compound of the French embassy for about a fortnight and then trucked out to Thailand so that there was no Western presence in Cambodia at all. We knew at that stage very little about what was going on, but in July, on the 15th of July 1975, Henry Cam of the New York Times wrote a blockbuster story about what was happening in Cambodia. It started on the front page and ran for about 60 column inches. And Henry Cam, whom I did not know at that stage, had been up on the border interviewing a large range of Cambodian refugees who had come out and were telling a terrible story of forced labor, of executions, of a general tyranny that seemed almost beyond belief. I was unaware then, I read the Cam story, I was living in England at the time, I was unaware that almost contemporaneously, Father François Ponchot, who'd been a French missionary priest in Cambodia for 10 years, and who later wrote a very well-known book called Cambodia Year Zero, was writing in Le Monde very similar comments to the very similar details to those which Henry Cam was providing. These terrible stories of what was happening in Cambodia were dismissed out of hand by what I suppose one would call progressives. And not only progressives, but people who had no particular leftist orientation, but who'd been very much opposed to the American involvement in the Vietnam War. So that by the early part of 1976, nearly a year by this stage, after the Vietnamese the Viet Khmer Rouge had taken over in Cambodia, there were still people writing fulsome praise for the Khmer Rouge regime, saying it was a wonderful revolution. And at that stage, I was asked by a Japanese journal called Pacific Community whether I would write on what was happening. Well, I had not only read what Henry Cam had to say, but I'd also spent time in Bangkok by that stage talking to Cambodian refugees. And it was quite clear that without knowing exactly what was happening in Cambodia, that something terrible was happening. That executions were commonplace, people were being herded into collectives, overworked and treated in extremely dreadful fashion. Yet despite the evidence that was growing all the time of the nature of the Khmer Rouge regime, there were people still supporting the Khmer Rouge as somehow a wonderful new revolutionary success. And I found that when I finally returned to Australia in 1979, there were still people who were speaking in these terms until, as I report in the book, a left-wing academic at the ANU, where I was spending some time, said to me, "But why didn't you tell us what was going on, comrade?" Well, I had tried, and others had done so much more cogently than I did. It's one of the blots on academic thinking that people were prepared to disregard the evidence because it didn't fit in with their ideological preconceptions.
And you speak later, when you go back to the Thai-Cambodian border in the 1979 to 1981 period, and you are again interviewing refugees about what has happened. There is again, perhaps on the right this time, a reluctance to believe refugees' accounts of what was happening in Cambodia at that time. But you were commissioned by UNHCR to go to some of these camps and to interview Cambodian refugees and ask them under what circumstances they would return. What did you find when you happened upon these camps on the border?
Well, there were two sorts of camps. There were the camps run by UNHCR. There were a total of some seven of those. And it was in the UNHCR camps that I was carrying out a survey to discover under what terms these refugees, some 175,000 of them in UNHCR-run camps, might return to Cambodia, and what about their experience in Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge might have led to them fleeing into Thailand as they did in 1979. Of course, by the time these people came into Thailand, the country of Cambodia was under the control of the Vietnamese, with a protege Cambodian government, which had very little power. In addition to those, let's call them official camps within Thailand, and I should also mention that, of course, I'm using the term refugees. As far as the Thais were concerned, these were illegal immigrants, because Thailand has not signed the United Nations Convention on Refugees. In addition to those camps, they were spread out along the border, just over the border in Cambodia itself, what were known as border agglomerations. These were squalid camps, usually run by warlords of one kind or another, who had no particular political affiliation, but contained people who weren't quite ready to take the step of going into Thailand because they didn't know what that would lead to, but who were not prepared to go back and live under the control of the protege government in Phnom Penh. One of the camps I visited of this sort actually was less squalid than others. It was one associated with a former senior Cambodian minister, Son San, who'd been Sihanouk's economic advisor over many years, that was a core group that hoped to form an anti-Vietnamese liberation force. It never amounted to very much. And there were two or three other camps that were under the control of the Khmer Rouge that had retreated before the Vietnamese invasion. But the really big camps at places like Mak Mun, Nong Chan, Nong Samet, scarce can be readily described. Open pit latrines, primitive wells, bully boys with AK-47s, drunk most of the time, sometimes wearing women's clothes, rouge, painted toenails, an extraordinarily disjunctive society or lack of society that it was very difficult to find any way that they could be brought into any plan that might be developed that would solve the existence of refugees in Thailand and the border agglomeration population.
And indeed, that was your conclusion that you reported back to UNHCR, was that this was not necessarily a human rights problem or refugee problem, but it was a political problem, correct?
Absolutely. The fundamental conclusion was that there was no way that these people were going to return to Cambodia unless there could be a political solution. And the problem was that neither of the major powers involved in looking for a political solution, the powers on the ground, the government in Phnom Penh, dominated by the Vietnamese, and the government in Thailand, in Bangkok, dominated by people who were unprepared to recognize the sovereignty of the protege regime in Phnom Penh. So that although I did my consulting work in 1980 and 81, it wasn't in fact until 1991 that the bulk of the refugees returned to Cambodia.
You also spent a good deal of time in Vietnam, particularly from 1966 to 1971, and the book also covers these years. What was it like to be a historian in the archives as helicopters were buzzing around overhead and the entire world was focused on current events in Vietnam at that time?
Well, the short answer is surreal, because I was the only person doing this research into the 19th and early 20th century of Vietnamese history. There were other people looking at contemporary political affairs, but I would be sitting in the archives building or in the National Library in Saigon, turning over musty pages of out-of-date newspapers and colonial papers, and you'd hear the helicopters flying overhead and occasionally the artillery barrages on the outskirts of Saigon. It was an extraordinary experience. And the moment, of course, you went away from that rather cloistered experience of sitting in a library or in an archive building, the moment you started talking to people, everybody had an opinion. And I try to record what it was like talking to people, particularly in 1966 in the book. Everyone had an opinion. Nobody had an answer. That was really how things were. The lack of solution, the uncertainty, was just the dominant feature of life at the time.
You also recount this really surreal experience of staying for 6 weeks with Senator Le Thanh Bu, a South Vietnamese senator, and then traveling with him throughout the country, inspecting various sites in South Vietnam. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
I met Le Thanh Bu, the Vietnamese senator who kindly had me as his house guest for 6 weeks, through the intervention of a South Vietnamese diplomat that I'd met some time before. He was a member with the South Vietnamese Senate Defense Committee, which was headed by Senator Chan Van Don, who had been one of the key figures in the overthrow of Diem in 1963. He was no longer an active general, but he headed the Defense Committee, and it was part of his duties to travel around South Vietnam to check on the security situation. Now, earlier this year, there was quite a lot of media attention given to the fact that it was the anniversary of the Tet Offensive in the early part of the year, January, February 1968. People tend to forget that there was a history of South Vietnam that went on after that, that 1969, 1970, it was possible to travel in Vietnam and to travel around Vietnam in relatively secure circumstances. The situation when you went out of the countryside was something else again. So I, in circumstances that were never actually explained to anyone, other than to say, you'd be very welcome to travel with me, I don't think I was ever explained when I landed with this traveling party quite why I was there. I traveled while Chan Van Don and his associates would be briefed on the security situation in Vietnamese towns and large villages all over the country. It was an extraordinary experience. Chan Van Don, whose father I knew about because he'd been a Vietnamese would-be politician in the 1920s, was very ready to talk to me, and he told me of his estimate of how Vietnamese opinion existed. He thought that perhaps 20% of the South Vietnamese population was in favor of some form of accommodation with the Communist Party, the Northern Vietnamese Communists. He thought 10% were supportive of the South Vietnamese government, and that the bulk of the 70% were still waiting to be persuaded one way or the other. So we would travel from place to place, sometimes calling in at three or four towns in the course of our travel by helicopter, occasionally by fixed-wing aircraft, and be briefed on what the security situation was. Over and over again, we were told that the security situation was at the level of Hamlet Evaluation C, which meant that the bulk of the population was, if not under the control of the communists, more or less under the control of the government. Whether these estimations were correct was a matter of real doubt, and I still have in mind the comment of the American full colonel in a Vietnamese town called Thuy Hoa, where we landed late one afternoon, and the briefing was given, and at the end of the briefing, the American colonel took me aside and said, just the same old bullshit.
On that note, let's go to the audience for questions. Anyone have a question? I'll look to you. Yes, Richard McGregor in the back.
Thanks, Aaron and Milton. Milton, what was it like being an Australian diplomat in Southeast Asia from 1959 onwards when the White Australia policy was still intact and it really only, I guess, started to be unwound from the mid-60s? I mean, did that have an impact? Did it matter? Did it, how did that play?
It had absolutely no effect in Phnom Penh. Unlike some of my contemporaries who joined Foreign Affairs at the same time, who found it was particularly difficult in places like India and Sri Lanka, I think, particular memory of one of them telling me that it wasn't a problem in Cambodia. And we were, as I mentioned earlier, in quite good odour in Cambodia, not least because virtually at the time I arrived, we were involved in giving the Cambodian Railways 75 pieces of rolling stock and 3 third-class carriages. And this was really quite a large gift, which was well received by the Cambodians, although it did open up to me very quickly that life was not quite the same in Cambodia as in Australia, because just before we were to make a formal handover of our gift of these rolling stock and third-class carriages, someone came down from the semi-official newspaper and said, you know, if you pay us $1,000, we'll give you quite a lot of publicity. And I had to say, no, I'm afraid there won't be any payment of $1,000. So we handed over the rolling stock, and after a year, Canberra wrote to Phnom Penh and said, would you go down and find out if the Royal Cambodian Railways are happy about the gift we gave them? So I went down, and I was told, yes, we're very happy with the rolling stock. And I said, and the 3 third-class carriages? And there was a pause, and the head of the railway said to me, well, the governor of Pursat province is very happy with his carriage, and the governor of Battambang is very happy with the carriage. So overall, we're very happy.
Another question from the floor. Yes, Meredith Verall from the Lowy Institute.
Hi, thank you. That was such an interesting presentation and discussion. Thank you so much. I'm just wondering, you mentioned, Milton, you said that these friends of yours and the life that you lived in Cambodia before the Khmer Rouge, dancing with princes and these kinds of things, what impact do you think that the Khmer Rouge time had on Cambodia in the longer term, and the social engagement, the way that it operates with the outside world, this kind of longer term political and social implications? Thanks.
Cambodia today, it's a truism, of course, Cambodia today is totally changed from what it was in the 1960s. I mentioned my friend, and he's pictured in the book, Sisawat Pandravong. He was representative of another age. There aren't people like Sisawat Pandravong around anymore. French, which was a language of government when I went to Cambodia, and may have had something to do with my being sent there as well as my dropping the catch, French has virtually disappeared as a language in Phnom Penh, despite the best efforts of the French government to promote it. China, of course, given your particular interest, Meriden, China was a major presence and interest in Cambodia in the 1960s, but not in the same way as it is today, where I think it's something of an overstatement, but Gareth Evans' comment is at least a nice way of putting it, that Cambodia and Laos are paid up subsidiaries of the Chinese government. So the changes are dramatic, but I would say this, and I always have to comment, preface any comment about Hun Sen with the observation that I have been highly critical of him, and I think in many ways he deserves to be highly criticized. But we should not fail to recognize that Hun Sen, as this all-powerful, dominating leader, is very much in a Cambodian tradition. Before the French arrived in the 1860s, the dominant king of Cambodia, Ang Duong, was a dominant single figure who led the country. After the French departed, Sihanouk was a dominant single figure. There is nothing particularly unusual or odd about having a dominant figure in Cambodian politics, whatever one may think of that particular dominant figure.
Michael Sexton, I wonder that given the time that you were in Saigon from 1966 and some years afterwards, what your impression was at that time of the conduct of the war?
I was highly critical of aspects of the war. It was quite clear to me that the Americans were taking an approach to the war that was unlikely to bring sympathetic reactions from the, particularly from the rural population. The presence of free fire zones in particular. That didn't mean that I thought that one should immediately adopt a position which would say it's time for the North to take over the South. In fact, quite to the contrary. The people I came to know in Vietnam, starting way back in 1963 and coming to know in later years, people like Chan Van Don, seemed to me to be people who could not simply be dismissed out of hand as having no importance as individuals or the government in which they were, with which they were associated. So highly critical of the war, but at no stage personally adopting a position of saying, we should just abandon South Vietnam.
Indeed, in the book, you speak about some of your Vietnamese friends who you would meet, for instance, Dong Sinh, the librarian, as making it impossible for you to say that we should just abandon Vietnam because of the fate that would befall those.
I say in the book, and with some hesitation, I say I don't want to admit, it may seem lacking in intellectual rigor, that I just could not see that taking that position was an acceptable moral position. The other thing that perhaps is worth mentioning in response to Michael Sexton's question is that we can all cite and should cite the awfulness of My Lai, of free fire zones, and the way in which some Americans behaved. We should not disregard some of the actions by the communist forces, not least the killing of perhaps as many as 4,000 people in 1968 in Hue, where it's now admitted by North Vietnamese themselves, some of those who took place, that these were assassinations that took place without any justification.
You speak in the book at various points about your trips to Hue during the war, at one point asking Australian Army officers to take you to one of the late Vietnamese emperor's tombs outside of Hue. Meanwhile, helicopter gunships are spraying the perimeter of the base. But again, this, you have this sort of odd experience of doing archival research, historical research, in Vietnam in the middle of a war zone. What was that? What was your interaction with the Australian Army training team that protected you during some of those interactions like?
Really by chance, I visited the Australian Army Task Force down in Phuc Thuy Province in Nui Dat as part of an official visit. In 1966, I, by chance, met a group of warrant officers, Australian Army warrant officers in Hue, who rescued me from my intended hotel accommodation for the night, which was obviously a hotel for short-term utility. I found that the Army training team people I met were extremely frank and ready to give me a picture of the war that was really quite different to that provided by the Australian ambassador at the time. The head of the Australian Army training team in Vietnam in 1968-69, Lieutenant Colonel Russell Lloyd, spoke to me in with great frankness about what he believed was happening, and his view was the distillation of traveling all over the country, seeing the other members of the training team in operation. He also arranged, as you mentioned, for me to spend a night out in a province west of Hue at a place called Nam Hoa, where again I was given a privileged and totally unofficial view of what was going on in the war.
Yes, Michael.
First of all, Milton, congratulations on the publication of your latest book, and thank you for agreeing to launch it here at the Institute and for producing one of the most interesting and colourful events I've attended recently. Thank you. Richard kind of stole my question about what it was like to be an Australian diplomat in that era in Southeast Asia. So perhaps I can pivot and ask you about what Canberra was like when you served in those years. You mentioned dropping the slips catch from Arthur Tang, which was unfortunate of you.
In the covers, actually.
In the covers, right. Tang, you know, Tang is one of those formidable titans of the Australian public service as a Secretary of Foreign Affairs and later Defence. that people often say we lack these days. So perhaps I could just ask you the open-ended question based on your observations then and now. How would you compare the quality of the institutions of government, foreign affairs in particular, the kind of caliber of Australian diplomats today, the leaders of the public service in Canberra, and perhaps even if you're willing to do it, the quality of the politics that you observed in those days compared to today?
That's a very big question, Michael. let me try and answer it in bits. First of all, that Canberra in 1958, Canberra itself was tiny by comparison with now. The Department of External Affairs was very, very small. I think the total number of people who were classified as diplomatic officers was about 180, both serving in Canberra and overseas. It was possible to get to know them as a very junior figure to an extraordinary degree at the Canberra Hotel back bar on a Friday afternoon, in a way that I think it would be absolutely impossible now. People like Tang were dominating figures, yes, indeed, although the extent of any interaction, apart from failing to take a catch with him while one was actually in the department, was very limited. So there's not a great deal more I can say about that, and after I'd returned from Cambodia, I wasn't very much longer in the department before I left. I can say something in a careful fashion about Canberra in the 1980s, because I spent nearly 12 years with the Office of National Assessments, when people who had been my colleagues in Canberra in the 1960s were people who were in very powerful positions in Canberra. And I had the very good fortune to serve for a large part of the time I was at ONA with Michael Cook, who I think is one of the least known but most outstanding of Australian public servants. Contemporary Canberra, I go there a couple of times a year, maybe three times a year, so I'm not really in a position to comment on that. I will, however, say that in terms of my interaction with Australian diplomats overseas over the years, I continue to be extremely impressed by the caliber of the people we send abroad.
Thank you. Do you see any parallels today with the situation you described, where the facts were known but people only believed what they wanted to believe?
Well, I suppose you're referring to how people saw the situation in Vietnam rather than in relation to Cambodia. Well, Cambodia as well, of course. What I find extraordinary about the Cambodian situation after the Khmer Rouge took power and the way in which people were prepared to speak admiringly about what was going on was that the evidence was so strong that I just could not see how it could be disregarded. Whether one wants to see that in any sort of contemporary terms is another thing. It seems to me there was something different between the readiness of some people in the Australian diplomatic service at the highest levels to be admiring or at least extraordinarily optimistic about what was going on in Vietnam, as against the attitudes of other people, particularly in the Australian military. I think that was a reflection of something that occurs with all manner of people in not just our government service, but government services generally, that people in official positions find it difficult to be courageous enough to contradict their political masters. And that certainly was the case to some extent among some people in Vietnam. But just returning to the Cambodian case, I mentioned Henry Kam. I hadn't met Henry Kam when he wrote his blockbuster article in the New York Times in 1975. I didn't meet him until 1980, when I did my first consulting job with UNHCR. there was an interesting personal aspect to this, not about me, but about Henry Cam. Henry Cam himself was a refugee. In fact, he left Germany as a Jewish young man or teenager in July 1941, one of the last people to get out of Vietnam, out of Germany at that time. And he made the remark to me later on when I did get to know him. He said he could not understand why people wouldn't listen to what refugees were saying, and that perhaps, having been a refugee himself, it made him more sympathetic to listen to the refugees. Cambodia, what happened during the Khmer Rouge period, is now something most people, unless they've been intimately involved with Cambodia, don't spend much time thinking about. But I can't emphasize too strongly how by 6 months after, 8 months after the Khmer Rouge took power, the evidence of what was taking place was simply overwhelming. And for people who claimed to be academics who refused to take account of that leaves me angered even today.
Milton, what do you attribute the rise of the Khmer Rouge to? Been foreseen, do you think?
I don't think it could be foreseen. I think the explanation in part is very much associated with the experience of the people who came to power under the Khmer Rouge, plus the fact that they drew to support them the truly underprivileged of Cambodian society, the people who lived right on the edges of Cambodian society, for whom Phnom Penh was a distant, oppressive regime who only had any association with them to collect money and to corruptly abuse them in various ways. Pol Pot, Salat Sar, Khieu Samphan, the rest of the people who were the leaders of the Khmer Rouge, absorbed a particular vision of communism when they were in France as students in the 1950s, which was the hardest of hardline Stalinist views. And they believed when they went back to Cambodia that the regime under Sihanouk was corrupt in every possible fashion and that it needed a total revolution to be replaced and overthrown. And I think their feelings were further entrenched by the fact that they lived under terribly demanding circumstances in exile, in internal exile within Cambodia itself, in the 1960s. Pol Pot and his close associates went into the marquee and lived in desperately poor circumstances, plotting to overturn everything that they had seen as the source of corruption. And in those terms, life was not important. What was important was the triumph of the revolution. And of course, we know that the book that really had the greatest impact on Pol Pot himself was the book by the anarchist Russian prince Prokopkin, The Great Revolution. And the conclusion in that book is that the revolution, the French Revolution, did not go far enough. In Pol Pot's mind, there was no barrier to taking these ultimately dramatic, total conclusions and putting them into a reality. And they were able to recruit people who believed that there had to be a better life than the one they had experienced living on the outskirts of Cambodian society.
Ladies and gentlemen, the book is Pol Pot Solved the Leprosy Problem, Remembering Colonial and Post-Colonial Worlds, 1956 to 1981. You'll notice there is a bookseller in the corner. And if you want to read about the zigzag bar in Phnom Penh in 1959, you will have to buy the book. But please join me for now in thanking Milton Osborne for sharing this with us.